It's not too close? Just nodding and shaking of heads. Why a compiler or a narrator would put these stories together, maybe they were just dragging the bottom of the barrel at that point and they said, here's some stuff. However, I think if we look at it a bit closer, there are linking elements that an ancient storyteller, an ancient listeners would pick up on, and when it's all put together, they say, no, that totally makes sense. And I think, hopefully, by the end of this talk, you'll appreciate that stylistically, well, you might not appreciate the stylistic, but you might appreciate the point, I think, of the narrator is trying to say to us and say to his listeners is that God keeps his covenant. God is very interested in the promises that he's given to Abraham at points prior to this and confirming them all the way through. Still more shaking of heads. So, it actually begins in the previous chapter. In the previous chapter, you have Abimelech, Abraham, Sarah as the principal characters. Abraham goes into Abimelech's area, into his territory, and because he's afraid, like he was in Egypt, that someone would take his wife away from him, he lies, or they both lie, about this working at all? How about this? They lie about being husband and wife and say they are brother and sister, which technically they are, but it's still a lie. And Abimelech gets told by God in a vision, in a dream, saying very subtly, you are a dead man. The woman you have is this man's wife. And of course, Abimelech cries foul, which he has every right to do. At the same time, he did take another man's wife. And there's a lot of talking that has to happen and some reconciliation that has to go on, and Abraham has to pray. Nobody did right in that situation. But at the end of the chapter, what you find out is that God had closed up the wombs of everybody in Abimelech's household. How they knew this? I'm not quite sure what stretch of time this is talking about. This almost seems to happen within the space of a year, but it seems kind of ambiguous. How would they know that they weren't having children? I'm not sure. There must have been something that indicated to the people in Abimelech's area that something was not right and God had something to do with it. It was a supernatural thing. But it says at the end of the chapter that once Abraham prayed, then God opened up their wombs again. And then it kind of ends there. But that's the connecting bit. At the end of Genesis 20, you will find this barren population. They're not able to have children. And then immediately, at the beginning of chapter 21, it introduces Sarah as giving birth to Isaac. Sarah, who was 90 years old, who had been barren her entire life, was now not barren. So there's the stylistic linking. You go from an unfruitful situation to a fruitful situation, both of which are supernaturally ordained, as it were. And it says, the Lord kept his word and did for Sarah exactly what he had promised. She became pregnant, and she gave birth to a son for Abraham in his old age. This happened at just the time God had said it would. And Abraham named their son Isaac. After Isaac was born, Abraham circumcised him as God had commanded. Abraham was 100 years old when Isaac was born. So you have Abraham and Sarah, and now you have Isaac. And it's almost like a the print that is spared on this particular moment doesn't seem to cut it, because we've been building up to this point, right? We as a group have been sort of anticipating Abraham and Sarah having a child for the last number of weeks, months. Sarah and Abraham had been anticipating some sort of child for 25 years, ever since God had sort of said, you will have descendants. You will have many, many descendants. And so they've been anticipating this. Excuse me. And Abraham at points has doubted. They've both doubted. But Abraham has presented to God saying, you've promised me descendants to inherit this land, but you haven't given me any. Look, my heir right now is my servant. And so there's been a lot of doubts coming up to this point. And so you expect maybe a little bit more press on this moment when the descendant from Sarah has finally arrived. But it's really kind of sparse. But here it is. And the key language in this particular part of the chapter is, it happened just as God said it would. And in some translations it says, it happened at the appointed time. What this is referring to in the short term, of course, is that God had come to Abraham a year before, right? There's three men, and at the same time they had talked about the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. I'm getting that right, right? And they said, at this point, next year, Sarah will have a child. And of course, Sarah laughed, and Abraham had laughed at another point. And God said, no, this is going to happen. And so now, when Isaac does come, the reference to the appointed time is talking about to that particular prophecy. But in the larger scheme of things, I think the narrator is pointing to the fact that Isaac came along at just the right time. Not only because he was foretold specifically a year before, but all along, this had been God's intention. God doesn't deliberately string us along. Much as we, in our dark moments, in our private thoughts, think, this is too long. God is not taking care of me. God's not looking after me. This is not the way I had imagined. Isaac came at the precise time that God had always intended. He didn't decide a year before, right? He didn't decide a year before that, oh, well, in a year, you will give birth to a son. God always knew. He always knew that at this point, this was the right time when Isaac was to come. And I think similar language is used somewhere else in the Bible where it says, at the appointed time, in the fullness of time, God sent his son. Jesus came to earth at just the right time in our history. And all the things that had to be in place, we don't know. We don't know what makes it the right time, but God does. And the factors are so huge, they're beyond our understanding, right? And in this situation, again, why at this time? Why when Abraham was 100? Why when Sarah was 90? I don't know. So Isaac could have really old parents? Is there an advantage to that? I'm not sure. I know I wouldn't want to have children when I was 100. I feel like I should have been younger when I started having children now. Just because I knew I had more energy 10 years ago. But it happened at just the right time. And that's the key language, I think. When you read this and when you remember this story, as sparse as it is, the narrator makes very careful note to say, This happened at the right time. And this is important. Now, the party. Oh, I'm going to go back a little bit. So I declared, God has brought me laughter. All who hear about this will laugh with me. Who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse a baby? Yet I have given Abraham a son in his old age. Stylistically in the Hebrew, the last part of it is sort of a bit of a song. It's like a chant. And she kind of sings it. Or that's the assumption anyway, just the way it's put down. But also interesting in this part is that Isaac's name, Yitzhak, it comes from the same root for laughter. And when God, when he foretold Isaac's birth, it was in the immediate context of people laughing because they thought it was funny how ridiculous that was. And God said, right, that's going to be the name of your son. Ha ha. And now, Sarah, totally embracing the joke, as it were, says, God has brought me Isaac. She's brought me laughter. He has brought me laughter. Because it is. It's in a human scheme of things, it's a ridiculous thing. But it's a supernatural thing. Because she was, long past, as pretty as she was. I mean, prior to this, of course, right? You had a king who had kidnapped her. A 90-year-old woman had been basically kidnapped and taken from her family to spend time in this man's court. That's how gorgeous she was. Nevertheless, she was still 90 and physically unable to bear children. Abraham, on the other hand, he had more kids even after Isaac, right? We'll hear about this later, but he married another woman after Sarah died and fathered some more children. So he was good to go. Sarah, on the other hand, was not. So it was a supernatural thing for her to have a child at all. And it was laughable. But now it's laughable in a joyous kind of way, right? Like, you know how when you're so happy and things are just so good, and God is obviously having control of an entire situation, right? You just need to laugh. And part of it is because you are so happy, and the other part is that you realize how stupid you were. Because this is beyond your imagining of how this could come to be. And Abraham and Sarah had gone through a lot, and they made a lot of mistakes, and Hagar and Ishmael was maybe even just the least of them. But there it was. All right. Now it was a weaning party. excuse me. I have a real a frog down there this morning. Weaning was important in the ancient world, and it was celebrated because too often children didn't make it past their first or second year. It was a vulnerable time for a child just because of the hardships of life at that time, and especially for wanderers. It was a hard life. So births were celebrated, of course, but maybe that's why in the ancient world the birth of Isaac doesn't get a whole lot of press because quite often births were, you weren't quite sure to be entirely happy because too often the child might not be around in another year or so. Weaning parties, however, they've crossed the threshold. And when they could start eating solid food, generally, if they made it to that point, they're going to live. This is, I can see people's faces, they're thinking, that's really kind of sad and that's awful. It is. But it is kind of the way it was as well. So a weaning party was a way to let loose and celebrate and say, this child is going to make it. Despite the fact that God had promised that this was going to be, Isaac was going to be the one through whom Abraham would count his descendants, people are people, right? And we have doubts nonetheless. So they threw a party because it was tradition as well, and Abraham prepared a huge feast to celebrate the occasion. But Sarah saw Ishmael, the son of Abraham, and her Egyptian servant. Thank you. Fair enough. Sarah saw Ishmael, the son of Abraham, and her Egyptian servant Hagar, making fun of her son Isaac. The word used for making fun of, and scholars are a little undecided exactly what Ishmael was doing. Later on in Scripture, I think it's Peter uses the word in Greek that suggests that Ishmael was persecuting Isaac. To what extent a 14-year-old boy could persecute perhaps 1.5 to 2-year-old is unknown. Nevertheless, the word used has the same root as Isaac's name. It has an idea of laughter, but the tense that it's in suggests more ridicule. So in this case, laughter was turned to ridicule or mocking. And Sarah saw it, and she was understandably very upset. Her first child being mocked, whatever was going on, by this little punk who she didn't like anyway and didn't like his mom. They've got history, right? And so she says, "Get rid of that slave woman and her son. He is not going to share the inheritance with my son Isaac. I won't have it." That's written in the NLT. I think that's probably more or less what was said. Foot was put down. Now this poses a problem. And it's a problem that we don't see right away because we don't have the same types of issues. But up to this point, and it's been suggested through Abraham's actions earlier on, not in this chapter, but earlier on in the narrative, where God is talking to Abraham about his son that would be born through Sarah, and that's through whom he would count his descendants. But at this point, Abraham and Sarah had already taken matters into their own hands, and Abraham had a son, Ishmael. And Abraham, he's resisting God's way, because he says, "Oh, that Ishmael may live before you," which is to say, why can't Ishmael be the one through whom my descendants are counted? He's my son, legally binding. He's my son, and obviously he loved him, cared for him a great deal. Why can't it be Ishmael through whom my descendants are counted? And God says, no, it will be Isaac. Still, I think, just because of the reticence that Abraham has at this point, I think that he's still thinking that Ishmael, in some sense, is going to receive inheritance through him. Now, that's a big deal in the ancient world. We read about inheritance a lot when you get into the Law of Moses, but a lot of that was already a reflection of what was already happening. And you can even see, even prior to the Law of Moses, how inheritance works in the story of Jacob and Esau, right? Where Jacob goes to the point of stealing, according to Esau, of selling, buying his birthright so that he's considered the firstborn, and then taking the blessing that was supposed to be for Esau as well. And those two things are pretty big deals in the ancient world. because it would have marked Jacob as being the recipient of not only the blessings, but of the wealth as well. In this situation, not the wealth is important, but is not nearly as important in God's eyes as the covenant and the promises that he has given to Abraham. In the ancient world, the firstborn son would receive a double portion of the inheritance. So, if you had two sons, you'd divide your inheritance into three parts. And the second son would receive a third, and the firstborn would receive two-thirds. If you had three sons, then you divide your inheritance into four parts. And each of your three sons after the firstborn would receive a third, a fourth, a quarter, and your firstborn son would receive half. Get it? So a double portion. Now, and this sort of this calls to mind what Elisha wanted from Elijah. If you remember that story, Elijah says, "What do you want?" And Elisha says, "I want a double portion of your spirit." So what he was saying is, "I want to be your heir. I want to be your firstborn, as it were, in a spiritual sense." And at this point, Abraham is thinking, Ishmael is my heir. He is entitled legally, and not only just within my family, but in front of everybody else in my community, whatever his community was. They're expecting that Abraham would have given a double portion of his inheritance through Ishmael as his firstborn son, because he's legally, it's his firstborn son. And so, in verse 11, we read, this upset Abraham very much because Ishmael was his son. And literally it says, the word was evil in Abraham's eyes. It was really, really bad. He had a real problem with that because he felt like he was stuck. Now what? I've got an angry wife who wants my firstborn to have no share of the inheritance and have her son have all of it, despite what God had said. So at this point, we can expect that God is going to step in, and he does. But God told Abraham, "Do not be upset over the boy and your servant. Do whatever Sarah tells you for Isaac. Isaac is the son through whom your descendants will be counted." And literally what he says is, don't let it be evil in your eyes. Let this happen. It'll be okay. Nevertheless, this must have been a bad, bad taste in Abraham's mouth. And in order to get it over as soon as possible, it says he gets up early the next morning, prepared food and a container of water, and strapped them on Hagar's shoulders, and then he sent her away with their son, and she wandered aimlessly in the wilderness of Beersheba. Throughout this entire narrative, I've been reading from an English version, and it mentions the boy's name, Ishmael, just so that we all know who we're talking about. In the original language, he's never referred to by name. At this point in the narrative, it only ever refers to him as the boy. So there seems to be a definite purpose by the narrator, by Moses, to say, start forgetting about Ishmael. He was referred to as the boy. At this point, it's all about Isaac going on from here. And this is all part of the covenant. Ishmael is not a part of the covenant. We won't even mention his name. It's all about Isaac now. So Hagar and her son, or Abraham's son, the boy, were sent away with nothing. Okay? Nothing. They had some food. They had some water. We have to assume that Abraham was so cruel as to give them only a little bit. I think when he strapped some water on her shoulders and gave her food, it was enough for her to get to somewhere. But from whatever state of mind Hagar was in, she got lost, because it says she's wandering aimlessly. If she'd gone from point A to point B, they would have been fine, but who knows? The first time Hagar was found wandering in the wilderness is she left on her own choice, right? And she sort of seemed to have a destination in mind. At this point, though, she's been kicked out, told to go with nothing, and who knows what her state of mind was. We can only guess. But there she is, wandering aimlessly in the wilderness with no water. Because it says, when the water was gone, she put the boy in a shade of a bush, and she went down and sat by herself 100 yards away. "I don't want to watch the boy die," she said, and burst into tears. She's not being melodramatic. She's lost. She's in a state. Her boy, he is a 14-year-old at least. So you think he might have had a... I don't want to judge. We shouldn't judge. But it seems like he was probably suffering from the lack of water at this point, because she leaves him under a bush, and then she just starts crying. But here we have God stepping in again. Another thing to keep in mind in this chapter is that God seems to be very active. He has to keep showing up. And he shows up, and the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven, "Hagar, what's wrong? Do not be afraid. God has heard the boy crying as he lies there. Go to him and comfort him, for I will make a great nation from his descendants." Then God opened Hagar's eyes, and she saw a well full of water. She quickly filled her water container, gave the boy a drink. And then, very briefly, it tells us what happened to him. He became an archer. He lived in the wilderness of Paran. His mother got him a wife, and he lived generally happily ever after. And that's it. And we get a brief glimpse into Ishmael's life later on in chapter 25, but it's not about Ishmael anymore. It's done. However, we kind of wonder, what about the connection between this part and the next part? And I think there's a stylistic technique here where the narrator is saying, all this took place, this is what happened to Hagar and her son. It happened in the wilderness of Beersheba. By the way, something else happened there. And then you get into the next part, because of Abimelech. Abimelech comes to Abraham. And Abraham's in this place called Beersheba. And we find out later that it's not called Beersheba until after this episode is finished. And it's telling us how it got its name. So Abimelech, and we know Abimelech, right? Abimelech was the one that kidnapped Abraham's wife and then was told off for it and received a very scary visit from God. And I think that stuck. I think that really stuck with him. And he shows up to Abraham and he says, God is obviously with you. I smile at that because I can imagine what he's thinking about when he says this. Abimelech probably would have been a polytheist. He probably had a number of gods that he worshipped personally. But he had been visited by the one true God, which had never happened before, obviously, in his entire life from any of his own gods. So despite the fact that he believes in a multitude of gods, when he says God is obviously with you, what he's referring to is Abraham's God, the God that had showed up in his dream and told him he was a dead man. God is obviously with you, helping you in everything you do. Now, why would he say that? Why at this point, I wonder? I think Abraham, very recently in Abimelech's mind, has become a force to be reckoned with. Not only because of God's visit, but he sees Abraham, and most people that lived there probably would have seen Abraham as just a wandering nomad. He'd come from the east, and he'd been living in the land for the last 25 years or so, but he wandered around. He owned nothing. And everybody that lived in the land, they owned something. They'd been there for some time. Their descendants had come there many years before. They owned the land. And so they perhaps regarded Abraham and his family with a bit of aloofness, looking down on them as basically nomads, just wanderers. Some have suggested that the word Hebrew comes from a word meaning just a wanderer or a nomad. But I think at this point, Abimelech's come into contact, and he's felt free, obviously, at one point in his life, to take what he wanted from Abraham by taking his wife. But then he gets a real slap on the wrist, does he not? And he gets scared. I think God showing up in your dreams, that's a scary thing. And something happened to his whole household. Not only did God appear to his dream, but God had supernaturally closed up the wombs of the women in his household. And that's a scary thing. So now Abimelech's kind of reeling from that. And then he sees 100-year-old man and a 90-year-old woman have a child. And I think the breaking point for Abimelech was Isaac. That's my suggestion to you. So at this point, now that Isaac has made it through his first year and a half, 2 years, and he's weaned, Abimelech is thinking, this man is having descendants now. He's having children. I have better make nice. So he shows up, and to Abraham he says, swear to me in God's name that you will never deceive me, my children, or any of my descendants. I've been loyal to you, so now swear that you will be loyal to me and to this country where you're living as a foreigner. Abimelech is taking Abraham seriously, as he should. And now we're starting to see Abraham's acceptance sort of into his community that God has told him to be not a part of, but to live amongst. And it's interesting that he says, swear that you'll never deceive me, because Abraham's already done that, right? He's already deceived Abimelech by saying, she's my sister. So he wants to get that out of the way. And because he showed up with his army commander, I think what we're to read from that is that what Abimelech's really wanting is a non-aggression pact. I won't fight you, you won't fight me, let's deal truthfully with each other so that there will be no problems between us and the land in which we are living. And Abraham says, yes. But then immediately comes clean about a problem he's been having. And the problem was that a well had been taken away by Abimelech's servants, and so Abraham and his flocks could not get water. That's a pretty serious thing, especially where they're living. In that area, it's very dry. And Beersheba is sort of a focal point because there is water there, but nowhere else for a long way around. So to not have water is a pretty serious thing. So there's a connection between Hagar and this story as well through the idea of water. We have so much of it, it's hard for us to understand just what a big an issue this was. But if Abraham didn't get the rights to the water, to the well that he had dug, then he was in a serious problem. He would have to move or die if he stayed. And maybe he was already in a state where water was becoming an issue. So he tells Abimelech, and Abimelech says, this is the first time you've told me of this, and and sort of softens the blow, as it were. And then they make a treaty. Abraham gave some of his sheep, goats, and cattle to Abimelech, and they made a treaty. The word is the same word that's used earlier when God makes a treaty with Abraham. And we've talked about this before. The word used is to cut a covenant. In the Hebrew, you don't make covenants, you cut them. You only ever cut covenants because they were that strong, they were that binding, that when you cut a covenant, you actually had to take those animals that are referred to, you cut them in half, and then the two parties walk between them. So by the words used here, we have to accept that Abraham and Abimelech together cut those animals in half and walk between them to seal the terms of their covenant, which was, we won't fight each other, we will deal truthfully with each other. Now, as a separate issue, Abraham then takes seven lambs and sets them apart. And of course, Abimelech says, what is this now? What are the seven lambs for? And Abraham replies, please accept these seven lambs to show your agreement that I dug this well. Why seven? Because seven is a perfect number. It's a round number in the ancient mind, for whatever reason. And perhaps it has to do, going way back in the ancient mind, God, whatever you believed at that time, a God somewhere, in most stories, created the world. Evolution didn't exist, okay? In the ancient mind, things didn't come together by chance. There was always a reason. That reason was a deity of some sort, much higher, much stronger than people. And that deity created the world in seven units, 7 days. So therefore, seven became a fairly important number. It was a number of completion. It was a round number. And so therefore, if you wanted to represent something that was done, that was complete, you gave seven, or you received seven, whatever the case may be. You might, us in our culture, we might give 10, because we're sort of a decimal-based culture, right? 10, or a dozen, especially if it's rolls. You never give somebody just eight rolls. I don't know how they get away with that in the bakeries. They just give eight. Should be a dozen. But seven was a perfect number. And then they named the place Beersheba, which means well of the oath, because that was where they had sworn the oath. What's interesting, though, is that the word used for seven and the word used for oath are almost the same word. And they come from similar roots. Therefore, to take an oath in the ancient world, and in Hebrew in particular, is to seven oneself, quite literally. To take an oath is to seven oneself. Because that, when you sevened yourself, you're taking on this idea of a round number, of perfection, and that it was binding, it was complete. So they sevened themselves, they used seven lambs to do so, and they called the place the Well of the Seven, or the Well of the Oath. It became known as Beersheba. And after making their covenant at Beersheba, cutting their covenant, Abimelech left with the commander of his army and returned home to the land of the Philistines. Just briefly, these Philistines do not appear to be the same Philistines that David and the earlier judges fought a lot in later years. So it seems that the covenant that Abraham and Abimelech made at that time seemed to last for as long as they were around. The Philistines that are referred to later, that lived along the coast, that the judges and David and Saul and later Israelites fought, they were a different group that had come from the Mediterranean area and had settled along the coast. And they were much more aggressive, a lot more hostile to Israel. So they didn't have this agreement. Those that lived along the coast were not under the agreement, under the covenant that Abraham had made with this group of Philistines, which seemed to be a group that had come much earlier and had settled in a different area altogether. There's still some confusion about that. I just wanted to let you know. In case you're wondering, why were they fighting the Philistines then later? Why did David kill Goliath? I mean, that was sort of against the this covenant that Abraham made, right? Probably not. But to pull it all together now, these three stories highlight and underline the covenant that God had made to Abraham. In the first story, God had told Abraham that he was going to have descendants as many as the stars. And that the promises that God was making to Abraham would be counted through his son. And then more specifically, he says, Sarah, your wife, is going to bear your son, and you will call him Isaac, meaning laughter. So the first story is a fulfillment of a specific promise, a specific covenant, part of the covenant that God had given Abraham. The second part refers to an earlier promise where God says, I will confirm my covenant with him as a perpetual covenant for his descendants after him. Therefore, it was very important for God that Ishmael not be in the picture. Now, this seems kind of harsh, but God had made the promise, right? God had made the covenant. And he says, it's going to happen in the way it's going to happen, in the way I say it's going to happen. Ishmael came along because Abraham and Sarah got ideas of their own. And they wanted God to work with that. And we do this, right? We do this in our lives. We mess up, and then we want God to work with it and say, well, I messed up, but can you sort of gloss this over? And I think God sometimes does that. But in this case, he said, no, I'm not working with Ishmael. Your descendants will be counted through the son that I'm giving you, not the one that you made on your own, as it were. This is very important to God. So while it may seem harsh, I think God had a plan and he was sticking to it. And so the promises and the covenant also went through, not Ishmael, but Isaac. And it's at this point in our Bibles where God, he specifies the son whom he's going to use. And so all the promises, all the covenant fulfillment came through Isaac, not Ishmael. And there's a lot of stuff out there at this time. The Arabs, the descendants of Ishmael, are claiming that these promises were meant for them too. But I think it's pretty clear myself. I think it's pretty clear that God made it clear to Abraham that it was only through Isaac. And then the third story, God is confirming his promise of the land to Abraham in the covenant. I am the Lord who brought you out from Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess. At this point, Abraham has possessed nothing, right? Not one square foot of the land that he's been wandering around in for 25 years. And the people living there have been treating him as a wanderer, as a foreigner. But now, finally, he owns a well. And that's a pretty big deal. And so these three stories together confirm God's working in Abraham's life. And that God is slowly, it seems, slowly to us, but he's confirming and drawing together the promises that he's made to Abraham. This is happening, Abraham. I am God, and I do fulfill my covenant. Let us pray. Father, we thank you for your word this morning. We thank you that you are a gracious God and you deal with us in the way that you deal with us. You could deal with us a lot more harshly than you do. And you were gracious to Hagar, you were gracious to Ishmael, by you did give him descendants. But you're gracious to Abraham in the way you worked with him, even though he failed in so many aspects. And he doubted you many times. I think we can take comfort from the fact that you continued and you didn't give up on him. You stuck to your covenant. And we can take that with us this morning as a God. You are a God, our God, who keeps his promises, that fulfills the covenant that you've made with your people, and that you are someone that can be relied upon. We thank you for these lessons from your word this morning. In Jesus' name, amen.